So welcome, everyone. We are so excited to have you today for this podcast, where we're going to be talking about the concept of balancing cannabis industry growth with public health. This is not a topic I've seen addressed very often, which is one of the reasons I wanted to bring in some great guests today to have this discussion. So I'm Dr. Amanda Ryman. I am the Chief Knowledge Officer for New Frontier Data. We are a data and analytics company that serves the legal cannabis industry. And today I have some great guests here from West Monroe, who are going to be joining us for this conversation. So Ian Nugent and Jeff Peeler. Sorry, I should have asked this before we started. Did I say it right?
Peeler.
Peeler.
Yeah, potato peeler. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Everybody always calls me Amanda Raymond. So I totally get it. So Ian and Jeff, maybe you can just take a few minutes and tell our audience who you are. Ian, why don't we start with you?
Thanks, Amanda. Hey, everybody. My name is Ian Nugent. I'm a principal over at West Monroe in our supply chain practice. My work in the cannabis industry spans across strategy, operations, and transformation. At West Monroe, we've worked with three of the top five MSOs within the United States, as well as a smattering of single state vertically integrated operators. And prior to joining West Monroe, I also worked in the cannabis industry briefly in New Jersey. Jeff, kick it over to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Jeff Peeler. I'm a partner in our consumer and industrial products practice at West Monroe. At West Monroe, we're a global consultancy of about 2,000 people. And in the cannabis space, we do everything from retail operations, a strategy on, what is the go-to-market plan, and technology. What do you need today? What do you need tomorrow? And how do you get you there? As well as do a lot of consultancy in the M&A space, from diligence to integration support. My background is actually very, maybe not cannabis. It was I was a design engineer designing cars for a while, and then did M&A came over to the cannabis space. So I've been leading projects with Ian for about 3 to 4 years now.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you both. I think that this is going to bring a really interesting and well-rounded conversation, because I think this is an important conversation, because the cannabis industry is at a critical point. We've had some markets that have been open for over a decade. We have new markets that are coming online now. And cannabis has enjoyed a very long history of propaganda, meaning that there is truth around cannabis. It is very rarely stated, either by the industry, by the government, by advocates. Cannabis has been this very emotional issue for a long time. Claims tied to things like insanity, claims tied to things like curing every disease that exists. And of course, we know that the truth is somewhere in the middle. So we want the cannabis industry to succeed. Legalization is one piece of it. Legalization is removing criminal penalties surrounding cannabis activity. Then there's a whole other side of it, which is regulation, which is, okay, now that there's no criminal penalties associated with doing a certain activity, how do you ensure that the public has access to safe products? And how do you ensure that businesses have the opportunity to provide safe products while still making sure that there are regulations put in place to protect the public good and also help the industry grow? Now, this can be a very, very difficult balance. As we'll get into, cannabis, much less risky than a lot of other, what we would call maybe vice activities like smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol, but not risk-free. On the other hand, we know from industries like alcohol that the industry makes most of their money off of the heaviest consumers. And while the same risks may not exist for heavy cannabis consumption as they exist for heavy alcohol consumption, it doesn't mean that they're zero. So I think we want to have a conversation about what role does regulation play in balancing the ability to allow the industry to grow, but also to mitigate potential risks, reduce potential harms, educate consumers so that they can make good choices about which products they consume. And how do operators work with regulators to make sure that the regulations that are put in place are supporting their business and yet at the same time giving us longevity? Because what we don't want is to see a lot of health-related problems, public health and safety-related problems start to arise. And what that does is it really pushes legalization back and has people wondering whether it was a good idea and maybe we should go backwards. When I was at Drug Policy Alliance, we used to talk about drug policy, especially as a pendulum that swings back and forth. And you have periods of a lot of prohibition, and then you have periods of more relaxed regulation, but it doesn't keep going. Eventually, it swings back in the other direction. And your job is to make as many gains as you can while we see a more permissive attitude among the public. And that's what we've been seeing with cannabis for the last decade or so. We also want to talk a little bit about how this works in other highly regulated industries like healthcare and banking, where there's also a question of how do we balance regulation and how do we balance the growth of those industries with the public good. I think we can definitely think of some examples from banking, like the housing crisis back in the mid-2000s, from healthcare, like the overprescribing of opiates, where we saw that balance maybe come a little out of balance for a while and the impact that that had, especially on vulnerable consumers. So this is what we're going to get into today. So if you're a policy wonk, if you're somebody that has a cannabis business that's been wondering, how does longevity look in an industry that is very highly regulated, but also has implications for public health and safety, then this is definitely the podcast for you. So those are some of the things we're going to get into today. And I'm going to start with a very basic question, which is, why do we even care? Like, why is there this need to balance industry growth with public good? So I'm going to start there. And the first question I want to throw out is, let's talk about some of the challenges. Like, why are we doing this? And why are we doing it if it's so challenging? And what are some of those challenges? So whichever of you wants to start with that question.
Thanks, Amanda. I'll jump in here. I think, you know, talking about the why, I think you nailed it in the intro. The pendulum example, it really just encapsulates it. There needs to be a long-term, sustainable, predictable approach to regulation that provides clear expectations for operators to know what is the business environment that they're operating in. How are they going to be able to remain profitable? How are they going to be able to grow within the industry? And then on the consumer and patient side, being able to expect a reliable, safe product that has a repeatable experience time over time. And really, this is at the crux of why we need to pursue those regulations, because without the balance on the business side being able to perpetuate a common commercial interest where there is a reason for people to get involved, there's not going to be a safe product on the other end for whether it be patients with medical conditions or for consumers that are just looking for a recreational product. And at the end of the day, it pushes people back to the legacy market, unregulated products in somewhat of an unsafe manner.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I echo what Ian said. It's like the thing is, everyone would the industry would grow short term without regulation, and it would actually crush itself in the long term without regulation. And so when you think about it, like, we need both, and it has to be, as Ian alluded to, predictable, so that we can then grow and understand what's coming around the next corner. And, you know, all it takes is one change, and the rug could be ripped out, and everyone is now scrambling to figure out what's coming next. And so, you know, I think the biggest thing is predictable, is what people are looking for right now. And in this industry, nothing's predictable. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about what consumers are looking for, right? One of the big benefits of regulation from a consumer perspective is standardization, right? And, you know, cannabis flower is a little bit different because cannabis flower is always a little bit unpredictable, given that there's a variety of THC levels depending on where it is in the plant. How people react to cannabis flower is very different because it's an immediate effect. But I remember the days of early medical cannabis dispensaries in the Bay Area, and you'd walk in and edibles would look like a bake sale. It was like a brownie that someone made in their kitchen, mm-hmm. wrapped in cellophane. No safe server, no were their hands clean, no this is how potent this is. You know, the bud tenders would say, well, eat like a thumbnail's worth and then see what happens. And so especially if you're a medical patient, like you want to be able to go in and know that this is 10 milligrams of THC, that it's been tested, that it's been produced in a clean and safe facility. And so I think that the regulations give consumers that. And I also think, to your point, it gives the businesses a roadmap, right? I mean, nobody wants to get sued because their product made someone sick, and regulations helps prevent that from happening. Now, there was a case recently with a dispensary in Oregon where a consumer went in and was talking to a bud tender, and they advised them, apparently, I'm going to say apparently because none of this has been proven yet, but they advised them to eat a 40 milligram THC edible product, which is a very high dose for a naive consumer. They had a adverse experience because of that, and now they're suing the dispensary and basically saying, you gave me bad advice. You told me to consume more than I should have consumed, and I had a negative outcome related to that. So I think regulations from a business perspective, and we don't have really regulations over what bud tenders can say other than they can't give medical advice. But the need to package it so they even know that that's 40 milligrams is something that you wouldn't have without regulations. And so, you know, I would get asked a lot, well, why don't we just make it like tomatoes? And I'm like, you think tomatoes aren't regulated? Like, fruits and vegetables are still regulated, even if they're tomatoes. So everything that we consume is regulated, and that's for liability. If we get sick, who gets in trouble? Who said this was okay for me to eat? So I do think it makes sense from a consumer standpoint and from a business standpoint to have regulations. But what are some of the challenges there, especially when we talk about a product like cannabis that has been kind of over-demonized for a long time, and assumptions about harm have been magnified beyond what they really are? How does that present challenges when we talk about regulation?
I think that your point about the over magnification is a great call out. And, you know, when we're talking about what are the challenges in the regulatory world for cannabis, I feel like it's a very fine line to walk where you do want to provide a repeatable, expected customer experience. Just like you said, where, you know, if I buy a Coca-Cola in New Jersey or if I buy one in Minnesota, I have an expectation of what is going to be. And it's the same that you would want for a cannabis product of the same brand. But at the same time, some of the challenges, and you know, I see it really in the Northeast too, some of these, some of the regulations, especially in the consumer experience when we're dealing at, you know, point of sale and dispensaries, it can create almost an illicit feel, whether it be with the way that dispensaries are segmented at 3 points of interaction where you're being checked outside, you're being checked before you come into the actual show floor, and then being checked at the point of sale. I often see armed guards. You're often being, you know, given bags that have no branding. They're being sealed. All the windows are frosted. Whether that be state regulatory requirements or really even requirements just to obtain insurance, which ends up being a state regulatory requirement, these become onerous and again push the pendulum back towards an illicit feeling or over regulatory considerations for cannabis and keeps people out of the market. Unwilling to maybe experience or try to have a new experience with it, and just continues to perpetuate some of the, you know, the hill foundings that you mentioned before.
Yeah, I think part of it too is like customer education or consumer education. You know, the challenges, especially with the hemp industry right now, it is something where, like in Minnesota, you have you know, hemp-derived THC drinks, and you can also buy them in Wisconsin, where it, you know, cannabis is not legal. And so, if I'm a consumer, I'm like, well, wait a second, I thought it was illegal. What is this? And how is that regulation? And so, all of a sudden, now I'm a consumer, and I'm like, what am I doing? Like, what regulation is applied on it? What's not? Like, how, you know, who's looking at this? And if I go to a brewery in Minnesota, I can consume a THC drink. And I'm like, what's in it? Like, is it really 5 milligrams? Like, and who's doing this? Is it the brewer who's putting five? Like, all of these questions are there. And so when you think about like the challenges, it's like, well, not only is it just cannabis, now it's cannabis and hemp. And then we're now talking about like the consumer experience where you're like, well, if I have a bad experience, whose fault is it? Is it a lack of knowledge, a lack of regulation? Yes to all. So it kind of, the hemp industry and that type of, what's happening there is also causing challenges to regulators.
Absolutely. And I think that that really speaks to the lack of federal regulation, right? I mean, each state comes up with their own rules. And then you have the hemp industry, which basically in most states has no rules. So consumers are very confused, right? They don't understand the Delta 8 vape pen that they see at the convenience store versus the cannabis that they get from a dispensary versus the hemp drink that they're getting from Wine and More. What is the potential harms? So anyone can come up with pretty packaging, but if nothing's being regulated, how do we know where it's being made? That the people who make it know how to make sure that that is a safe product. Really, except for Minnesota, we really haven't seen states regulate hemp products. We've just seen them ban hemp products. And as we know, bans don't work in a lot of ways. They just drive products further underground. We have states that are doing nothing, that have no cannabis regulations and no hemp regulations, like North Carolina, where things are just proliferating and you're really seeing it everywhere. So I think hemp kind of provides a new spin. And when we talk about other highly regulated industries like banking and healthcare, they also have huge challenges in balancing regulation with the public good. And yet they have federal regulation, right? They have the FDA, they have the FDIC, like they have these federal agencies. So, cannabis shows that, federal legalization won't necessarily solve these problems, but it may make them more uniform, to where, we're kind of battling one issue versus an issue that varies from state to state to state. So I want to move on to our next question, because I think we're kind of already getting at it, which are, what are the key components of cannabis regulation that impact health and safety and contribute to financial stability? And how are they complementary and in conflict with each other? So maybe starting by talking about some of the more pragmatic regulations, which are around testing, labeling, safe, responsible consumption. So in a lot of states, including Washington State, where I live, that's maxing out the THC per edibles package at 100 milligrams, where each piece can be no more than 10 milligrams. We also have things like purchase limits. So you can only purchase so much at a time. Some states are talking about things like THC caps. We have talks about potency-based taxation, which is something we haven't really seen take off, but is something that's definitely on the table. We have requirements around testing, but in California, we learned that lab shopping is very common. We also have things like inversion, where products that are not from the regulated supply chain make their way into the regulated supply chain somewhere down the line. So it's still, it's still a new industry, even though it has been around for over a decade. But how do you see some of these key components both working for the public health side, but also the financial growth side? And where does that conflict lie? Jeff, I'll start with you this time.
Yeah, I think it's a unique question because, like, obviously, as you mentioned, like, there's the every package has a COA, so you know what you're going to get, and like, you hope that as the industry matures, on a state level, like, that exactly what's on that, the package is what you get, and there's no lab shopping, so like, you definitely want that. Now, the other thing too is like the training, as we talked about the case in Oregon, like, you want to make sure that everyone is informed, and it would be great that the regulations are, hey, this is the type of training you want, and like, we see a lot of turnover at the budtender position. And so how do you make sure that every customer experience is the same, is unique, and whether I'm buying from Ian or buying from someone over here, I get the same information, and I know what's being presented to me is what I'm going to get. So like, that's going to be like very, very important to make sure that we have. I think when you talked before about the other regulations that in other industries, you think about healthcare, like, if you're buying Tylenol or a generic, it's identical. Like, you know what's in there, and it's very regulated. The other thing that you see in healthcare is like price mandates in a sense. Like think of like Martin Shkreli and when he purchased that company for and raised the price from like $7 to $500 a drug, and it was geared towards the most vulnerable people. Like we don't have any type of protections right now from pricing as well. And you think about that, like if I'm a medical patient, am I going to be paying $5 or $500? And it's state by state right now. Like, on a federal level, like I would love to see it where if there's a medical condition, like it should be very much like the industry that you see there. So when we think about that, like the regulations can bring consistency, whether you're in Minnesota, New Jersey, California, wherever, but also like stability. Like we talked about before, stability in pricing and stability for the operators who play in that, so that they can predict their profitability and forecasts on a go forward basis.
Yeah, well, talking about the predictability, one of the regulations that really makes that difficult is the lack of interstate commerce, right? So much of price in these states is based on how much is produced versus how much is consumed. And so you have producing states like Washington, Oregon, and California that produce more than they can consume in the state. And part of that is just population, and part of that is local control, like in California, where you have large parts of the state that have no retail activity. And so, where does that product go? Well, it goes out of state illegally, and the price plummets because there's just too much product. So, in terms of farmers and retailers being able to predict pricing and build out long-term financial models, regulations that stifle the product moving around the country, like we would see any other commerce moving around the country, I think really impacts that predictability. And that's one federal regulation I would really like to see change, because when we look at produce, produce is produced where it grows best and cheapest, and then it is sent other places. Setting up production facilities in climates like Minnesota, not only is it very energy intensive, but it doesn't really make sense from a just crop perspective. So I totally agree with that. Ian, what do you think? Oh,
One
go ahead.
other thing to comment on. I think it's a very good point. Like we see in limited license states, like we see more predictability because like the supply and demand and the players. Like when you have excess supply, that's kind of when you start to see the bad actors come out. And they come out because they have to. If I can't pay my bill, I can't grow and or I can't maintain. And so it's a short-term viability play that you see. And like we've worked with clients that have excess supply and they're very large MSOs that are under the microscope and they can't do anything illegal or else they're getting shut down. And so when you think about this, like a lot of the regulations have to be like, why is this happening? Not like, let's go after that one bad actor, because you can win the battle, but you're going to lose the war. And so like when you think about it, it's a very, very good point. And like, well, the limited license limits the number of supply, and hopefully that then goes and matches demand. And when you get way out of whack, that's when you have it really come bite you. And one of the clients that we're working with, an individual, like it's an energy equation. Like, it can't be created nor destroyed. And so if you follow this and we have all like the data transparency, you can see who the bad actors are and you can catch them. But now it becomes, well, why is it happening? And so like, it's the regulation should be focused on why is it happening, not, stopping it. So,
Right.
but I agree. I think the biggest thing is open up the borders and or the state borders, and a lot of this will go away.
Yeah, I agree. Ian, what do you think?
Think Jeff's comment about winning the battle but losing the war is very spot on here. I think, taking a bigger view about the interaction between public health, the cannabis industry, and regulations, one thing we really haven't talked about or thought about it is the positive feedback loop or the public-private partnership together. And I think the license structure is a great example of that. With the cannabis industry being so nascent, still evolving, it's a great opportunity for operators to work with regulators on an ongoing basis in a public-private partnership fashion to give them feedback saying, hey, look, this is what we're seeing in our market, in our industry. This is what we're experiencing. We have a common set of goals of wanting to A, set up a profitable industry for the state, provide tax revenue. B, provide a safe product for both consumers and patients alike. But to do that, it's going to be a give and take between both operators and regulators. And I think the limited license structure is a great example of that because, yes, on one hand, you do want to make sure that you provide large swaths of economic opportunity, especially to people who have been unfairly impacted by the drug war historically, but also make sure that the industry does stay solvent, is able to provide product in a reputable fashion to consumers. And doing so really does take that, the relationship between regulators and operators and say, hey, look, this is what's working, this is what's not, let's tweak it and go on, as opposed to just laying out a regulatory framework, handing it off to a regulatory body and just letting it run for months and years.
Well, I think that's a great point, and I'm glad that you brought up, people that have been impacted by the drug war. We see a lot about social equity programs. I was on the Cannabis Regulatory Commission for the City of Oakland when we designed the country's first equity program ahead of legalization. And I do think that there should be opportunities given to people who have been impacted by prohibition. Absolutely. But we're also seeing that the high cost of compliance, the amount of regulations that are in the industry make it very difficult to be successful without capital. So when we talk about things like limited licensure, it makes sense from a supply and demand and predictability industry growth perspective. However, going back to the public good, which I would argue also includes community good for communities that have been impacted by prohibition, if we have a limited license structure, who gets those licenses? Is it going to be the people that have the capital that the state is like, oh, this person's going to be successful because they have a lot of capital behind them? We've seen most equity programs, as well-intentioned as they are, not be successful because it takes a lot of money and a lot of business acumen and a huge support team to make it in this industry. And giving someone a license ahead of someone else sounds like a good gesture, but is that business going to be able to open their doors? Are they going to be in business a year later? And so, talking about future financial stability of the industry balanced with regulation, how do we have operators work with regulators to have them understand what's doable and what is actually going to foster success among people in equity programs who don't have, tons of investors, or if they do get investors, sometimes it's predatory investing, and that ends up not being a good deal for them. So, what does that balance look like? Still wanting to have a standardized experience for the consumer, making sure that the product is safe, but also understanding that overregulation is going to make it nearly impossible for somebody from an equity scenario to be successful long term.
This is such a difficult question, and one I truly don't think that's been solved or answered properly within the United States. I think from lessons learned and examples that we have, balancing both again a growing and nascent cannabis industry that does need to be stood up on a state by state basis, very capital intensive, very intellectual property intensive. And then also making sure that there is a large amount of social equity, community investment, so on and so forth. It's a fine line to walk, but from my perspective, the way that I really view this equation is, on one hand, being able to give licenses to experienced operators to be able to come in, help mature, and really lay a foundation for an industry. But then again, when we're going back to the public-private partnership, taxation plays a huge role here, where you can tax these established operators who generally have very good margins due to their extensive knowledge and operations, and be able to reinvest that in local community operators who are more than likely, furcated in how they interact with the cannabis industry. We're not talking about a vertically integrated operator for anything, but reinvesting in dispensary owners, manufacturers, processors, or cultivators one step at a time to grow the industry from a social equity perspective, bottom up, ensuring that there is a large swath of participation.
Yeah, I love that idea. And I think that, you know, it would make all the sense in the world if the regulators want the industry to be successful, that they would reinvest in the equity businesses with the tax revenue. Here's the rub: the public. So when you're trying to pass an initiative, especially, and you're relying on public votes in order to do that, they have very specific ideas about how they want that tax revenue used. And unfortunately, and really it's the fault of prohibition, not of people, there is an idea that people that got in trouble with cannabis under prohibition were criminals, that they were doing something they shouldn't have done. And that if I didn't make the decision to break the law, why would they make the decision to break the law? So saying, well, we're going to make this money off of cannabis and we're going to give it back to those folks so that they can run businesses, it's a hard sell, unfortunately. And I know in California, when we were running Prop 64, you know, the public didn't really even have the confidence that the state was going to do anything right with the tax money. We ended up putting it back into a community reinvestment fund that went to communities that have been impacted by the drug war, but not for cannabis, for things like youth programs and substance abuse treatment and public health programs, because that was something the public could get behind. They agreed that vulnerable communities need services. They didn't necessarily agree that we should be helping drug dealers be successful in the industry. And it's tough. And this goes back to what we were talking about, the propaganda around cannabis and what it meant to be involved in cannabis makes it diff it makes it easy for the public to support not using police money to go after people who use cannabis. It makes it difficult for them to have empathy for people that participated in an illegal trade prior to legalization. So, Jeff, I don't know if you have any thoughts about equity.
Yeah, I think the more you can level the playing field, the easier it gets. Now, yeah, that's kind of the name of it. But now, if you think about like the state of Minnesota, what they've done is they've limited the number of licenses that each person can have or the number of retail locations. And they've also limited like which counties you can put it in. So you can't have five, you know, in one county and have that, you know, quote unquote monopoly in that market. And so like they're doing that in order to level the playing field, you know. And so like that's kind of, you know, as Ian said, like no one's really mastered it, but I think that's probably a step in the right direction. You know, the other thing that we're starting to see is, you know, the more we can standardize the tools and processes used, whether it be state regulator driven, like it helps the individuals stand up their business. So while the capital constraints are still very high, if you can get a store in a box, so to speak, like it helps Jeff stand up a store, it helps an MSO stand up a store, all of those things. And we see more and more. And so whether that's regulator driven or just the, you know, the maturity of the market is going to help level the playing field for anybody who participates.
Amanda, one other comment real quick. Going back to your call outs around, you know, the public at large maybe not willing to be willing to invest in people who were impacted by prohibition. I think this is really where the public partner private shit public and private partnership shines, especially at a state regulatory level. You know, one of the unsung issues in the cannabis industry is the nimbyism that occurs at the municipal and county level that you often see excluding businesses, excluding, you know, certain people from, you know, granting access to operate within their boundaries and putting really onerous restrictions that go above and beyond what the state says because of their own misinformation or preconceived notions. I think, you know, New Jersey, where I live, is a great example of this, where home rule's already so prolific and it continues during the cannabis industry, where it continues to perpetuate harm by locating dispensaries or businesses in areas that already had disparate impact, continuing, you know, trends from yesteryear and also perpetuating preconceived notions. This is really where state regulators need to step in, whether it be the actual cannabis regulatory specific bodies or even the legislature as a whole, to say, hey, look, we're not letting this continue. We're not necessarily giving you an out here. This is not, we're not asking you to participate. This is really what is going on, and you're going to get, you know, you're going to get on with it. We can't end up in a situation with NIMBYism, like with housing, where all of a sudden, you know, we're at a huge deficit of housing, and then that would carry over the cannabis industry and some other deleterious way.
Well, I think that that's a great point. And, going back to other highly regulated industries like alcohol, we do see from research that there's higher densities of alcohol outlets in vulnerable communities and economically disparate communities. We also see the types of alcohol that are sold in those stores be different than the types of alcohol that are sold in more economically affluent areas. And I think that goes back to one of our original thoughts, which was, how do we balance public good? So if we have these ideas about what dispensaries are, that they're these seedy places that attract crime, that should only be located in certain parts of town, does that then prey on a certain type of consumer, and kind of create this disparity among consumers where certain consumers are exposed to a lot of dispensaries, very easily accessible. Other consumers have to travel in order to have those dispensaries, which they still want to do, but they just don't want them in their neighborhood. The research shows that there's no association between dispensaries and crime in the neighborhood. So, that's a fallacy. We also have mixed research on whether access to dispensaries actually increases consumption. We know it doesn't among minors, but among adult consumers. There's really no reason to fear. But Ian, as you mentioned, a lot of dispensaries still have that air of prohibition to them, right? California is starting to change. States that have had legalization for a while are starting to change. But I remember the old days where it was armed guards and you can't use your cell phone and you have to check your ID five different places and you don't want people seeing you coming and going from a dispensary. So there's no signage and it is very clandestine. But one of the things we were talking about is that the consumer is evolving. Right. So the consumer is changing. And where we used to see cannabis consumers primarily being made up of people that were consuming cannabis under prohibition, meaning people that were willing to break the law in order to access their product, we're now seeing a very wide variety of consumers, with the largest jump being among the older population who would not have done something that was going to break the law, did not want people to see they were going into a dispensary. But now, like my parents who are in their 70s and they live in Chicago and they go to their local dispensary and they get what they need and it's a fine, experience. People are normalizing their dispensary experience where it isn't like I was likening it to like Willy Wonka's candy shop. Like it's not like that anymore. Now it's like stopping by Target on your way home from work. You're going in, you're getting what you need. So given that we're seeing kind of a consumer evolution happening where consumers are more sure about what they want, they're more comfortable with the different products, how does that adapt when it comes to regulations? Like, how do regulations become malleable enough so that they can evolve as the consumer evolves? Or do they need to? Or do we just put them in cement and say, this is how we regulate cannabis? And if they should evolve, what around them should, where should that evolution be taking place? Either.
Yeah, I think like it should be a pro. They shouldn't be cemented. Like I think that's the answer. They should not be cemented. Now, how do you and what do you need to? I think it's basically an open dialogue between operators and regulators. And if you think about this, like the information sharing is actually what's critical so that we know where to focus. And so if we have a different population, well, is it a new form that they want? Is it a what should be regulated and why, and evolve that? If you think about the packaging, and we talked earlier about like how regulated it is, like, well, what happens if people, if it's hard to open, or if it's something where like we can have something more sustainable? Like right now, it goes through like 17,000 loopholes and discussions to get something that's changed to be a sustainable packaging, and like why? Because of regulations and change. It's like, well, why should it be that difficult if it's a no-brainer type of activity to go through this? And I think like the discussion points is always like we get in the way of ourselves because of the name of regulation. Well, hold on. Well, why do we want to? It's like, well, to make it more sustainable, to make it easier, to fit the needs of our consumers, whether it's recreation or medical patients. And I think like the open dialogue is just kind of missing today. I feel like it's a, well, this is what it is. And so now let's continue forth with it. And I think like by not having an open dialogue, we're constantly trapped. And it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing at all. And we see that continuously, whether it's in Florida, California, or even in Minnesota.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, to your point, we have to ask ourselves, why do we have this regulation? Is it because it's needed to protect people? So, like labeling potency, for example. Yes, that is needed. People need to know how strong the product they are consuming is. Making sure we have a standardized dose of edibles. Yes, I think that is important because people want to know each piece that they eat is going to have the same effect. Do we need to have five layers of plastic between the product and the consumer? Probably not. Do we need to have childproof jars on flour? Probably not. I don't see a lot of little kids wanting to eat flour, stick it in their mouths. Edibles, absolutely. Those are very appealing. Your teenager knows how to open a childproof jar if they want to get it flour. So I think, a lot of these regulations, it's like, is this needed to protect the consumer from possibly having an adverse event happen to them? Or do we have this because of our beliefs about needing to protect people from cannabis and from the activity of buying cannabis? And I think those are things we have to, that those questions, right? Is, if we got rid of this regulation, would somebody have a negative experience where they could sue us? Or are we just feeling like cannabis is more dangerous than it actually is? And therefore, we're putting on extra regulations because we have a belief about needing to protect from the plant itself, which I think kind of goes back to the days of propaganda. Ian, what do you think?
I think you both nailed it on 2 points. Jeff, with the constant conversation and dialogue around, what is needed, what is going on, and Amanda with the why, because I really do feel the why is so important. Oftentimes, I think especially in the Northeast following Massachusetts, so many states just looked at their regulatory framework as a playbook, and it looked almost like a copy and paste as the Northeast grew. But what Massachusetts needs isn't what these other states need. So I think as we put together both the why and the dialogue, it becomes a constant evolution on a per state basis. And to me, that part's so important because, again, we don't have a national market. We're doing this on a per state basis with individual demographics that are experiencing the cannabis product through their own cultural lens, through their own experience, and most importantly, in their own time. Just thinking about, comparing a California to a Pennsylvania, California, who's has such a different cultural relationship with cannabis, different legal relationship with cannabis, those markets, that market's needs and its consumer needs are going to be totally different than what Pennsylvania needs are. So on a per state basis, having that open dialogue between, consumers, patients, operators, and regulators, who are really the three entities that make up a market, what is needed to serve each of those interests, it seems really the best path forward.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think what ends up happening sometimes is that regulators are more influenced by the non-cannabis public, the people that have the fear, the NIMBYs, right? The people that are like, you're in charge of making sure that we don't devolve into this like devil's lettuce society. And so they have to balance themselves, right? They have to balance the desires of the people who are like, permissively allowing this to happen, even though they don't agree with it. And the people that are consuming the product and the people that are the businesses, right? Because the businesses want to be financially successful. The consumers want to have products that they can count on. The outside public has fear about what it means to have cannabis accessible and available. And so they want to see a whole bunch of regulations that they believe are going to stop minors from accessing cannabis, are going to stop people from smoking in public, are going to stop people from driving after consuming cannabis. Like that's what drives them, which is a different set of priorities than the consumer, which is a different set of priorities sometimes than the business. So you mentioned, understanding the consumer and who they are and the demographics, which I think is a really good segue into our last section, which is the role of data in decision making. So, New Frontier Data, we are a data company. Our whole goal is to show who's using cannabis, why they're using it, who's using dispensaries, how they're accessing it, why they're accessing it, and really unpacking the data behind the industry and behind consumption patterns. So, how can data serve as a gut check to align industry practices with public health goals and kind of drive this collaboration that you were talking about, Ian?
Yeah, so I think data is such a powerful tool here because at the end of the day, it doesn't lie. And really, for cannabis, the cannabis industry writ large, it's in such a unique position where it is incredibly data rich just through its regulatory framework. There's not many industries that you can think of outside of life sciences that have end-to-end supply chain tracking with where is it coming in, what are all these disparate factors, how does it move throughout the network, demand signals, and ultimately even at point of sale, who is buying it, how much, when, where. And even sometimes, with medical patients, you might even get a why. With that knowledge going in, you're able to obtain pretty transparent insights into trends across demographics and products. Some of these opportunities that I really think, from a regulatory perspective, you're really able to help identify underserved as well as overserved communities. I think, we called that out before, where again, on a per state basis, certain municipalities might still prohibit it. Some quick data analysis, not only geographically, but demographically, will be able to illuminate, hey, who are we really reaching? Who are we not reaching? And then ultimately allow you to correct for those errors. Next, you can really look at things like abuse trends and use trends and understand what products are very popular and why are they popular to make sure that as an operator, you can provide them to your consumers, and especially making sure that patients are well served. I think the patients always get lost in these conversations, especially as markets transition from medicinal to adult use. But the data really can do tremendous things for medicinal patients where you are able to see, hey, what products, what forms, what strains are serving what patients in what conditions, and then really be able to develop some pretty strong recommendation algorithms to help treat patients proactively.
I think that's a
Sorry.
great point. And I just want to mention real quick that just speaking to patients, in our last consumer survey, we asked people what products they have access to. And even in adult use markets, even, flower, about three quarters of folks said they had access to. When you get down to the more medicinal products, things like tinctures, pills, topicals, that number went way down into the 20 percentile. So when you're thinking about, yeah, we have an adult use market, great, everyone has access to everything, but that just isn't true. And understanding that, I think, is really important because, again, we do have an issue with patients getting their needs met in an adult use market. And so understanding their lack of access, I think, is very important. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, don't be sorry at all. I couldn't agree more. And I think lastly, and this is, again, sorry to beat a dead horse, but getting into the private public partnership perspective, data gives you a great real-time signal to be able to track outcomes and successes and whatever it may be for existing regulations, to understand how taxes are impacting operators, to understand, hey, are these businesses still going to be able to remain solvent? Are we providing an operating environment that's inclusive to all operators, talking about large MSOs down to single license holders? Talking also about, hey, what kind of patients and consumers, what are the numbers that we can serve per license type? I think this is often an under-asked question and goes back to Jeff and talking about, what does a limited license structure look like? And, combining that with the why of your regulatory framework, Amanda, being able to say, hey, look, we know for every X amount of patients, we're going to need Y amount of licenses, taking a quantitative look at that to make sure that you maintain that equation of, a profitable industry, but also a robust consumer environment. Very important. And then lastly, I think, where you have these incidents like in Oregon, and again, going back to, maybe the NIMBYs or naysayers, where they point to that as a great example of, hey, this is why we can't, let cannabis proliferate. I think, again, that the data really can tell a strong story here where, hey, look, we can track incident reports on, a per transaction basis and really be able to illuminate the success of the cannabis industry.
Great points. Jeff?
Yeah, I think that, data is just data. You have to use it for something. And like cannabis, the cannabis industry is relatively still immature and relatively new. And like we see the cannabis industry actually have a lot more data than a lot of the other industries that we serve. But yet we don't see people using it that much. And like as we've talked about right now, how much studies have come out about cannabis and how has that impacted the reform and regulations? Like very little. Like it's still based off of feelings. Like even though we've seen like, hey, it does or does not promote like XYZ, it's the same exact regulations about fear and where things can be placed are still happening, even though data is still there. So it's kind of a unique industry. And we talk about the alcohol industry where it's like drink responsibly and it's on the consumer to manage. In cannabis, it's the exact opposite, where it's on the operators and, the regulators to mandate this. And so even though data is widely available that counter, that counters much of the fears, we still see that. And so, the other thing too is like with the operators, they have a lot of the data for leading and lagging indicators to say, hey, should we change this category? Do we need a new flavor? Do we need a new form? A lot of them are starting to use that and actually grow and are much more advanced on their data consumption and data insights than a lot of industries that we work with on a regular basis. And so, there's a lot of data usage coming up in the cannabis industry, and it's probably going to only get more and more as we get more mature. And if it becomes federally legal, they're going to be light years ahead of a lot of industries from data consumption and data insights.
Well, I think that's a great point about how much data that the cannabis industry has. And like you said, it's kind of by necessity, right? Because there's so many feelings out there about cannabis that in order to really understand what's real and what's not, you have to look at data. Now, of course, the Schedule I status of cannabis still greatly restricts the human research that can happen using the actual plant. But we have seen a huge amount of data on what happens to youth use once cannabis is legal. You know, what happens to crime? What happens to domestic violence? What happens with opiate prescriptions? But you're also very right that people make decisions with their hearts, not their heads. And so you can put a ton of data. I mean, there's so much data now on the fact that teen use has not increased since legalization. Like the federal government's done studies, researchers have done studies. Like this is something that we have seen across the board. And yet you still have people that are against cannabis, whether that be governors or legislators, standing up and saying, we can't legalize cannabis because we don't want teens to get it. And it's like, well, we kind of know that they don't now, but you know, they're still preying on that feeling. And in my 20 plus year history working on this issue, anytime I hear a legislator say that they've changed their mind about medical cannabis, it's never because they saw a study or somebody put data in front of them. It is always because I met someone that was positively impacted by medical cannabis. And now that I've met them, this N equals one, which in the research world, we will tell you is not a valid or reliable way to do research. This one person that said that it helped them, I've now completely changed my mind on this issue. And on the one hand, there's plenty of people out there that advocate and talk about their personal experiences, which is great. From a researcher's perspective, it can be very frustrating because you're putting the data in front of the policymakers and in front of the regulators, but they're still acting on a feeling. And when we were doing Prop 64, we would ask people who were against it, well, what is it? Like, what is it? Because if they anything that they listed, we could counter with data. And they would say, I just feel it's not a good idea. And it's like, how do you combat that with data? So I do think we have to get over this idea, and this goes back to the why of the regulations, that we just have a feeling that this should be in childproof containers. We just have a feeling that dispensaries shouldn't be open past 6 o'clock. We just have a feeling that we should ban these products without really looking at the data to see whether the data warrants it. But data works both ways. So at the same time that we can be saying, look, teen use doesn't go up and crime doesn't go up and opiate prescriptions go down. Also, sometimes data can become a tool for predatory practices because if you understand who the biggest consumers are and what they like to consume, even if the data says it is not a good idea for people to be consuming this much of that product, from a business perspective, it becomes very tantalizing to use that data in order to target certain populations, even though there's a public health risk. So, Jeff, do you want to maybe talk about that door that swings both ways?
And data is the greatest thing and the worst thing, depending on who has it and how they're using it. And we've worked with restaurants and quick service restaurants to identify like where should their next 100 stores be located. And part of the stuff and studies that we do is like what predicts profitability. And so like we study like 100 plus variables to predict profitability at a store, like at a single store level. And we look at traffic patterns, the competitive intensity, population density. Like I said, we do 100 variables. What our data scientists have found was that the top three predictors of profitability for a specific store are the percentage of low income, so below the poverty line, the low education level, and high obesity rates. And so if I'm an operator of a quick service restaurant, I want to know those three things, and I'm going to put that smack dab in the middle of that to maximize my profitability, which is the exact opposite thing you want from a public health perspective. And so like you can use the data for profitable growth of an industry, and you can also use that to probably drive healthcare costs through the roof and not do public good. And so like for all of these things, like you have to balance of what are we trying to achieve? And again, it goes back to the why, but also like how do we need to counter that to make sure that it doesn't shoot yourself in the foot in the long term. And so, we talked before about short-term gains and long-term viability. Like in the cannabis space, it has to be long-term viability. And so like, it's almost up to everybody to manage ourselves to make sure that we aren't doing ourselves harm for the long term or causing like, a news headline that's going to then tank someone's perspective because they feel now that they saw this headline and now next thing you know, like they swung their vote a different way.
Yeah, I agree. I like to tell consumers, cannabis consumption is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Cannabis is a plant that will be beneficial to you probably most when you're older. So you want to be able to have that good balanced relationship with it so that you're not getting burnt out early because of consumption. And the fact that there's no fatal overdose, let's face it, it does remove a boundary for some people. The fact that there is no hangover or throwing up with rare exceptions, like there is with alcohol, removes boundaries for some people. And there is a belief, even though it's not accurate, that there's no overdose of THC when there absolutely is, that there's no such thing as dependence on cannabis when there absolutely is. And again, the risks may be lower and they may be less fatal in terms of outcome, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. So, Ian, how can data be used as a guiding tool for the cannabis market in making some of these decisions, given what we've been discussing with kind of the two sides of the coin?
Going back to some of the previous comments we talked about here, I think, with data being able to be a real-time indicator, you're able to flag issues, as they're happening, or you're even hopefully do some predictive analytics to get ahead of the curve. Things that we're talking about again, where maybe there's a perception again where cannabis does not have a dependency component or does not have any kind of overuse or abuse component. This is, I think, a great example of where data can come in, especially in states where there's, lax or non-existing, purchase maximums or, THC limits. And we can start to see, hey, are people really leaning in to frequent high THC purchases? What are these product forms? And, this is where we start to get into some of the public health component of are people consuming cannabis in a healthy manner? And then we can start to ask questions of Why are they consuming cannabis in this way? Do they know how to, I wouldn't say necessarily properly consume cannabis, but maybe have a more healthy relationship with cannabis? And then also look at the flip side of what are operators putting out there in terms of sales? What are they putting out there in terms of promotions and products? And is that matching consumer needs, or are they purchasing what's being put in front of them that's ultimately perpetuating negative consumer habits?
I think that's a great point. And, I wrote an article not too long ago comparing cannabis to exercise because I don't want to demonize cannabis. Cannabis in and of itself isn't actually a very healthy activity. Your body likes it. We have an endocannabinoid system. It can help with a lot of symptoms of a lot of different conditions. We know that. It's a healthier alternative to alcohol and some other things out there. But just like exercise, if I overdo it, I could hurt myself. If I choose the wrong exercise for me, I can hurt myself. If I continue to exercise, even if I have an injury, I could hurt myself. So, there is too much of a good thing, and it is about balance. And I think that, just like the data with exercise shows that, people who have certain conditions make them worse if they run or do certain activities. We use that as a guiding principles to recommend that certain people stay away from certain activities.
100%. It's not a panacea. And I think back to your pendulum example earlier in our conversation, where at one point, this was an illicit substance, and the public at large was told, devil's lettuce, you're going to become addicted, you're going to have all of these deleterious health effects. And as time goes on, DARE did no one any favors by perpetuating these myths. People come to see, okay, I'm not going to become addicted, I'm not going to overdose. And the overcorrection is now people think it's safe with, there's no considerations to have with it, or no considerations to use with it. And it's a huge battle to get that pendulum, I think, as you put it well, into a point of moderation. We don't want it swinging one way or the other. It's just in a point of stability to really perpetuate what cannabis can be. And I think one other comment where, Jeff, you were talking about where data is a tool and it can be used for, deleterious, or, you can really use some take some nefarious takeaways with data to do some things. And Amanda, I think you called it out well too, about one of the biggest drivers of acceptance with the public is, firsthand knowledge. And I think that happened with a multitude of different civil rights. And while we have this broader conversation of how we can utilize data, I do think we should also, not lose sight of doing things that necessarily don't scale, that aren't necessarily data driven. I think community outreach programs, specifically by operators, are a great way to connect with the community, not only to help destigmatize and normalize cannabis, but also get across these educational points that we're talking about, where cannabis can play a great role in your life, a great purpose-driven role in your life, whether it be re recreational or medicinal. And again, for certain people, maybe you would want to use it in a different way or not use it at all. Just anecdotally, one experience of mine working in the New Jersey cannabis industry, as Governor Murphy started opening up, put in a regulatory framework with the legislature, you needed to have municipal approval to open up in any given city. One of the cities of someone I was working with was really not for it, but hosting a few community events in a public park over the course of the summer, where we were able to invite the community in, connect with different operators and other industry participants and not, people in nonprofit spaces, were able not only to show the community, but its leaders that, hey, this is what cannabis can be in a commercial setting. This is how it can interact with the community. And that is such a powerful tool to go alongside those data-driven insights.
Well, I'm a social worker, so you'll never hear me argue against community outreach. And years and years and years ago, when I was working at Berkeley Patients Group, we had a community picnic, and people thought we were crazy. And we were like, "Look, we're like any other business. Your local hot dog store, your local record store back in those days, like they have community picnics, they have community outreach opportunities, and we're going to do that as well." So I do think it's important to kind of break through that green barrier and be like any other business in the community that wants to educate people on how to use your service appropriately and health in a healthy way, because that's what's going to bring long-term value in terms of a customer, is somebody who develops a healthy relationship with the product and it isn't like a boom or bust situation. Well, I could sit here and talk about this for the next 5 hours, but we are ending our time here. So I just want to kind of wrap up and kind of go over some of our key takeaways for today. We've talked about the cannabis industry and the opportunity to develop a successful cannabis industry that also addresses public health and safety. And the cement is not wet on this. Alcohol prohibition ended over 100 years ago, and we're still arguing and refining alcohol regulations. So this is a conversation that will continue long after the three of us are gone. We have to look at this as a long haul situation, and it's incrementalism, and we have to just continue to push and reinvent what it means to be a safely regulated industry. We talked about the role that data plays, and especially this collaboration, as Ian was mentioning, this public-private partnership, community partnership, and that this is a team effort. This shouldn't be anybody alone in a room making the rules. The industry has to understand what the regulators are trying to accomplish. The regulators have to understand what the industry is up against, and both of them have to understand what consumers are looking for from a legal regulated industry and the why behind the regulations. And are we developing this rule because we have this leftover idea from prohibition about the dangers of cannabis? Or are we developing it because we need it in order to ensure that the public has access to safe, regulated products and a standardized experience? And of course, this conversation is going to continue to evolve. And I'd like to think that we won't have any of those headlines that you mentioned, Jeff, but you know that we will. And you know that people are human and that we will have situations where people misuse cannabis, or where, Halloween time, we still get the people are giving your kids edibles stories in the newspaper. So we're going to continue to battle this. Cannabis was prohibited for a long time. The propaganda around cannabis runs deep. I will say that the people that were most impacted by propaganda are now aging out of power. People in the younger generations are now growing up with legal cannabis and may have very different ideas about what it means to have that as part of your life. But I think this is a conversation that we will continue to have and that we will continue to struggle with, because we want people to have legal access. We don't want people to go to jail for using cannabis. We want people that have been impacted by prohibition to have an opportunity to participate. We want people to have access to the products that they need in order to satisfy their recreational and especially their medical needs. But this is also an intoxicating substance, and it's not a substance without risk. And it's a substance that needs regulation around it in order to make sure that people have safe access. So I think that this struggle and this conversation will absolutely continue into the future. But I think that this is a great place to start. I think we've given some people some great talking points and thinking points around this topic. So, Jeff, Ian, any final words that you have before we close out?
I think the only hit the nail on the head with the why. Like currently, like we hear participants in the industry, like it's us versus them on the regulators, but it's not the why are they like that. It's maturity. The regulators aren't that really mature. They come into the cultivation facilities and they kick the tires and they look for the tiny things. And we've heard time and time again, and state by it's not one specific state. It's all states. They come in and they kind of disrupt operations. But it's Well, wouldn't it be better if they handed over all the data, or the cultivation data, to say, hey, here's where it is, here's where it went, here's the testing, here's where it's going, here's who consumed it, and have that data transparency? Like it would alleviate that disruption and have them focus on the critical environments and focus on the what must change. And like, do I really need to go check did you change the light bulbs in the in XYZ room like you were supposed to? Like doesn't really seem fruitful. So, getting past the us versus them and actually a combined and concerted effort of like, let's move forward and figure out the why is going to be light years ahead of where we're at today.
Great points. Ian?
It being in such the cannabis industry being in such a data-rich environment, one of the areas that we often see operators lagging in is applying data in really just traditional consumer product in applications. Three of the biggest use cases that come to mind that really support revenue growth and profit optimization, or end-to-end business planning. So talking about integrated business planning, where you're aligning financials with operations across the end-to-end supply chain. So determining bottoms up from a demand perspective, how much product do we need to cultivate, process, and then ultimately turn into to finished goods, and then in what kind of products, across categories like just regular flour, concentrates, oil pens, things like that, being able to look at it holistically and say, 3 months from now, we're going to need to have X amount of biomass to support, our Y financials. And then looking at it from, this is how much labor we are going to need, this is how much canopy space, so on and so forth. An additional awesome opportunity within the cannabis industry that, again, really goes underutilized is cost per gram monitoring. Being able to look at what is the really cost of goods sold that goes into making a finished good, making even just an eighth, going into things like energy use, going into things like packaging, of course, labor and fixed assets. These things aren't often tracked, but with the data that's available in the cannabis industry is so robust, you can easily track this and monitor this on a month over month, year over year basis to make sure that you are remaining economically competitive in a cost perspective. There's so many times that we see the differentiator between a successful and unsuccessful cannabis company is really just being able to control the cost of goods and control the cost per pound produced. And without having this ongoing monitoring that data can provide, there's no regulations, there's no really larger business interests that can save you. And then lastly, I think as Jeff mentioned before, just opportunity identification, determining what are your coral areas with the customers you serve in terms of which demographics like which products, which demographics purchase in what frequency, what are the initiating factors that drive purchases. Not only that can help you with your existing operations, but as you look to set up new markets, as you look to expand within existing markets, you can easily identify new opportunities, whether it be underserved communities, overserved communities you want to avoid, determining, market fit for your specific company, so on and so forth.
Well, I think that that is a great way to wrap this up. It's given a lot of people things to take away and to think about. And I will say out there, if any companies are like, oh yeah, we want to know more about consumers and what they're buying and why, and contact New Frontier Data. We do consumer surveys. We can do specialized surveys based on the exact things that you want to know, because I do think that the why behind the buy is important. And you can look at POS data, you can see what people are buying, but that's not going to tell you that women of a certain age in a certain part of the country prefer a certain product, and this is why they're using that product. So I do think that there's a lot of richness that we can get from the data to help businesses understand who is their market, what does their market want. And that goes into not only acquisition of product, what they have on their shelves, but it goes into how they market and how they talk about themselves and how they find their customers. So I do think that this goes with the maturity of the consumer, right? We're not just all marketing to 25-year-old men anymore. There's a wide variety of people that are using cannabis with a wide variety of products for a wide variety of reasons. And it's important for us to understand these nuances so that we're not just kind of hitting the same nail over and over again, but we're able to diversify our messaging and better track how our products are contributing to public health. Well, I think this is a very robust conversation. I want to thank you both for joining. I think that we're at the very beginning of this. I often say that we're very lucky. I mean, how often do you get to experience a time in society where something this big is changing? And this is huge. Cannabis was illegal for a long time, getting into medical consumption in the mid-90s and now into adult use, where almost every state has a cannabis law of some kind. This is a very unique point in history to be alive and to be working in this industry. In social science, we call it a naturally occurring experiment, because you get to study something as it's happening in real time. So I just want to thank you both for the work that you do, for coming on the show today. And for you listeners, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks
for having us.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.